melts silently to water, and the moon shines lonely in the night. Try and see the me that needs to feel you with me now. Somehow, I don't know how I've known since birth. I'm without you, water. Please send a message to me. It's free. So without you on earth, and without you by my side, singing till you hear me till we happen to collide.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, well, feels like we're living in an alternate universe, doesn't it? Stay tuned. Thank you. good morning. So, this will be a bit of a free-form program. I do have agendas to meet. Originally, I thought I was going to read something either really political or really apocalyptic, and I was looking. The only thing that I could find that really seemed to match the mood of the day for me was a great, great short story by Cyril M. Kornbluth, from 1951, entitled The Marching Morons, which is largely about a real estate swindler who is able to con a great many people who are very sheep-like in a far distant future. And the adventures that he has, unfortunately, I figure that the story would take about an hour to read, and there are other things to do this morning. And if you can hear me, you know, as I breathe, I go, you hear there's a little phlegm there, and I'm just not ready to do a live, not recorded, 1 hour long reading. But doing so, you know, how do I maintain some kind of relevance? I feel that there must be some relevance this morning, because when I woke up with what was by now yesterday morning, I had, for the very first time in decades, the feeling that I used to have as a child. I'm born in 1953. So I am born in the era of the Cold War, with all the saber rattling, or should I say missile rattling, that was going on. When I'm 10 years old, I'm living through the Cuban Missile Crisis and stuff like that. And we did drill tests, going to the shelters in school. And every day at 12 noon, there were, all through New York City, and where I was in Queens at the time, air raid sirens, every single day at 12 noon. And it was, you know, it did not do anything to soothe people at all. I don't remember exactly what year they stopped doing the air raid sirens, but it was, enough into my youth, so that I would wake up every single morning, I mean every single morning, and have a deep-rooted fear of a mushroom-shaped cloud. And I'm hardly alone. I think anybody near my age experienced that, and probably of other ages, and probably in other parts of New York and the country and the world. I was talking with a gentleman who hails from Egypt, who drove me over here this morning. I took a car service because I really didn't feel like doing the bus today. And he grew up also with constant fear of war and that kind of thing. Well, I had that this morning. I really did. I was like paralyzed for maybe 90 minutes or so. And then later on, I took a nap, and it's just been whatever. The word that I have been using, and I think that, you know, is shell-shocked, but that's not quite it, because shell-shocked, you know, is an early word for PTSD. It's a phrase that will probably change as time goes on, but it is nevertheless a indicative of the kind of total, near-paralyzing fear that one can feel, and it is back. So, therefore, in a way, the program will have a certain amount of business as usual. But in another way, it's also, well, this talk, this rap, this discussion about the state of the earth, the state of this country. I mean, I really feel like we stepped into an alternate universe. I'm reading a wonderful book right now by, now you see, I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, James Gleick. If it were German, it would be Gleick. But then, you know, there was my good friend John Gleidman, who's married to Margot Adler, and he was IE, and he would himself point out that, technically speaking, his name would have been pronounced in many places Gleidman. So it's either James Gleick or Gleick. I think it's probably Gleick. But anyway, he has a new book about time travel. I'm about two-thirds of the way through it, and it is an utter joy. It's the man knows his sources. He has cited, you know, starts out with H.G. Wells, but this doesn't stop him from mentioning, in fact, C.M. Kornbluth and Ursula K. Le Guin and a lot of Heinlein, because By His Bootstraps is an absolute classic story of its type, to, for God's sakes, David Gerrold. And each chapter is about a different aspect of time. And a lot of that includes, of course, alternate universes and the philosophies behind them. Now, this is not a book about science fiction. This is a book about time. And a lot of it over the, you know, traveling forward, traveling back, and, of course, alternate universes, is it, you know, and causality and effect. The philosophy that if somebody in the 17th century wrote down a note of music and somebody in the 21st century plays that music on, say, a trumpet, and the air vibrates at a particular frequency in reaction to that trumpet, which was the cause? Was it what was written 200-something years ago? Was it the trumpet player? Now remember, we're not discussing hard science or reality here. We're discussing philosophy, okay? And it's a wonderful book. What can I say? But I feel like this is a universe in which the impossible, the unthinkable has occurred. And it also strikes me that we're living in the same kind of a world that my parents must have known. My father from Nuremberg, my mother living mostly in Prague, but born in Frankfurt, both Holocaust survivors. My brother and I born here in the U.S. by design. They were among the very, very few allowed into the U.S. for particular reasons. And to them, it couldn't happen there. You know, it can't happen here. That's the old Zappa thing, and I've been threatening to play that. So, what of that? And as I'm saying that, I'm just thinking, darn, I should have started out with Dan Persson's movie review and then followed that. Because a sign-off has been defeat Trump. Well, that's a bit passé, isn't it? But we will get to his movie review almost immediately after we take a quick break. But I actually had a musical request. And I generally don't fulfill those, especially in the 90-minute version, as it has been for the last 5 years, of Hour of the Wolf. But I thought, yeah, This is an appropriate one, alas. So here it is, and then we will hear Dan.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Churn world serves its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Beat it up and ox speak. Grunt, no strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Fight down high. Fire and a fire representing seven games in a government for hire and a combat site. Left the West are coming in a hurry with the Fury's beating down your neck. Team, my team reporters baffle Trump. Tethered crop. Look at that. No plane. Find them. Uh-oh. Overflow. Population common. Do what it'll do. Save yourself. Serve yourself. World serves its own needs. Listen to your heartbeat. Slice and burn, return, listen to yourself churn. Lock it in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate, automotive incinerate. Light a candle, light a motor, step down, watching heel crush, crush, uh-oh. This means no fear, cavalier, renegade, steer clear. A tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world. Lester Banks, birthday party, cheesecake, jelly bean, boom, you symbiotic, patriotic, slam, but that's right.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. The conflict between the battle for equality and the struggle for identity can present itself in curious ways. Can you think of any particular piece of art, contemporary art, let's keep it to that, where a woman pursues a strange and elusive man whose unattainability serves as metaphor for the quest of life itself? I can't, but my cultural grounding is maybe a bit too stunted. Closest I can get is Kill Bill. Not sure that counts. The fact is, when you think of a mystical, metaphorical pursuit, it would tend to take the form of man pursuing woman. And if we are equals, why should that be? Why are the mysteries of life almost always associated with the feminine, and the incapability to fully comprehend be inherently masculine? I'm just saying that I'd like to see that shaken up a bit, but I don't think we're there just yet. In the Chinese film Cross Current, a young cargo boat captain, Cheng Gao, played by Kan Hao, who's piloting a shipment of contraband down the Yangtze River, meets up with the same woman, played by Zhang Zheli, at every port where he lands. She assumes different guises at each stop, a woman beseeching Buddha for guidance, a jilted lover, and her appearances coincide with the entries in a book of poetry written, presumably, by Chun's recently departed father. It'd be easy to say that the woman represents the eternal spirit of the river, but aside from me wanting to slit my wrists for merely uttering something so corny, director Chow Yang, who along with cast and crew spent 60 days living on the boat during the making of the film, seems to be going for something darker and more complex in his protagonist's spiritual journey. The crew, consisting of the captain's uncle and maybe his cousin, I'm not sure about that, pay severe prices for Chun's mystical quest, while Yang's camera journeys between stunningly beautiful natural scenery and the rusting vistas of the ports. There is a sense that the director is playing with the notion of inevitability, represented at one point by a sequence with both cycles through the locks of a massive dam. But whatever the goal, Cross Current is a quiet and entrancing study of spiritual quest. Werner Herzog doesn't really deal in ambiguities. He's pretty much certain nature is out to kill us. Not deliberately, it's just that nature has better things to do than worry about our petty concerns, and we just seem to keep getting in the way. As such, he's maybe found the best metaphor for humanity's tenuous status in the ecosphere with his new documentary, Into the Inferno, in which he follows volcanologist Clive Oppenheimer on a globe-trotting survey of the Earth's literal hotspots. Again, I hate myself for resorting to the easy pun, and the scientists trying to study them. In the course of their journeys, Herzog and Oppenheimer introduce us to the slightly crazy people who dare to get within frying distance of roiling and boiling magma, conveyed through a combination of intense original photography and archival material. And the director also explores how societies, modern and primitive, living in the shadow of volcanoes, deal practically and culturally with the ongoing threat. No throwing virgins into lava here, but the attitudes of appeasing a violent and capricious spirit and the overall pointlessness of such are omnipresent. And of course, Herzog revels in once again underlining nature's indifference to the affairs of us silly humans. How better to convey that than to point out that the deceptively solid ground that we all rest our feet upon is merely a thin crust covering a literal lake of fire. Yeah, Herzog once again overtly states this thesis, this time near the end of the film, and it's beginning to feel more like self-parody. But nevertheless, Into the Inferno is Herzog at home with the topic he loves, and it's a mesmerizing, terrifying, and sobering study. According to legend, director Greg Travis has spent 30 years trying to work the narrative for his vampire noir film, Dark Seduction, into some semblance of coherence. He's finally done it, mostly through the expedient of having his hard-boiled detective, played by Travis himself, who's pursuing a beautiful lesbian bloodsucker, connect each scene through voiceover narration. It works to an extent, and it can't be denied that the film, shot in black and white over the course of a couple of weeks, and featuring unusual walk-ons by such comedic likes as Julie Brown, Robert Schimmel, and Rick Overton, yep, the guy with the sledgehammer in those GE commercials, can occasionally hit some effective comedic and even dramatic notes. But time, both in terms of the length of the post-production phase and the film's runtime itself, work against it. You oscillate between feeling you're watching something daringly and wittily original and something that might be a fitting candidate for the upcoming MST3K reboot. Dark Seduction does wear a bit at the end, but it is an interesting oddity that rises above its limitations frequently enough to justify the extended gestation. I'm recording this on Election Day, I'm not sure what's gone on, but I'm going to presume that one way or another, the Union shall survive, and I can now go back to my comfy old sign-off. With that in mind, for Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
And thank you, Dan. This is indeed Hour of the Wolf over WBAI, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City at 99.5 FM. I have about 35, 40 minutes worth of recorded materials that I would like to get to this morning, and about 5 minutes worth of announcements to do that relate, in fact, to these recorded materials, or actually vice versa. But feeling in sort of a needy communal way, if you should like to call up and discuss and be on topic now, science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor, including how those may very well relate to current events, the telephone number here at WBAI is 347-335-0818. We're not going to take a lot of time for calls, but perhaps some. Perhaps it's me who needs to reach out. And if I had more than 24 hours to prepare this morning's show, I would have done just that. 347-335-0818? I guess so. We change phone numbers here so often that it is just, hard to tell, hard to know. Also, if you care to text me during the program, this is something that people have been doing. You can do so through Twitter, Jim Freund, J-I-M-F-R-E-U-N-D, or find me on Facebook, and the same thing. And I uninstalled Facebook from my phone, but I do have Facebook Messenger. Good morning. You are on the radio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm 10 years older than you are, so I do remember the early 50s. Quite readily. We did, in fact, have air raid drills once a week. I remember being told that if you were at home, you should listen to Conelrad. You remember Conelrad?
Well, the Conelrad station in New York was WBAI.
Oh, I didn't know
so
that.
So I had to operate as a board operator. We had to take Conelrad alerts. Before there was EBS, the emergency broadcast system, there was Conelrad. And WBAI 99.5 FM is the center of the FM dial. And somebody in some management at some point in the years thought that, well, BAI, we get into so much trouble with the government here and there that maybe if we were the Conelrad station, it would put us into slightly better standing. And once a month, a uniformed person, army, I guess, but what would I know, a uniformed person would come into the station and take out the bright orange envelope, the Conelrad envelope, that said on it, open only in case of instruction over the Conelrad system, and would replace it with a new one. And there would be a code. We would be given that code to know that it was real, just a la Dr. Strangelove. So do I remember Conelrad? Yeah. And that all ended when EBS came along. And then two other stations, I think WQXR and possibly NYC, became the emergency broadcast system stations. Well, also QXR, I know
QXR,
that for sure.
What did they mean when they said 640 and 1240? They always said tune into 640 and 1240. Were those...
AM frequencies.
AM, were those what? I'm sorry.
AM frequencies.
AM frequency, yeah.
On FM 99.5 and 640, 1240 are AM frequencies. 1240 probably way up there, like ultra high or marine band, something like that.
By the way, one of the interesting things about doing the air raid drills once a week was we were in grammar school. I was in grammar school then, and they always told us, hide under the desks.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
But don't look at the light.
Yes.
Don't look out the window.
Anybody who wants, just check out the movie. It's either on Netflix or Amazon or one of them called Atomic Cafe. And all of these films are totally available.
Yes. One other thing. Last night, when I woke up this morning, you will understand this because I'm sure you've read this. It's a great story. It's a great alternate universe story. I felt like H. Beam Piper wrote a story, the late H. Beam Piper, mm-hmm. wrote a story called He Walked Around the Horses. And it's a great alternate universe story because he did his historical research. Anyway, I do have a science fiction or fantasy or actual media question. On the 19th of this month, BBC America is running a Doctor Who called The Power of the Daleks, and I'm just asking you, because you know much more about Doctor Who than I do, is this something new, or is this something that has been already?
This is something that has been already and was lost. The soundtrack remains, so they animated it.
You mean it is a cartoon?
It is a cartoon made up of the soundtrack of an actual Patrick Troughton circa 1966 episode.
So this originally came out in 66?
Yes.
Okay, James, thank you.
And let me, by the way, the new Doctor Who, the forthcoming Doctor Who spinoff Class, is very good.
Really?
Yeah. Not as good as Torchwood, but very good.
Last question. Have you seen Doctor Strange yet?
No, I'll be seeing it Friday.
Good.
And that was another thing that I wanted for this morning, but I haven't put my hands on it. I only have reel-to-reel copies of the WBAI productions of Doctor Strange, Master of the Mystic Arts.
Arts, yes. By the roaring winds of Watum, among others. Anyway, the song that you should have played, well, Marching Morons would have been, and I why did I know you were going to say Marching Morons? It's a tremendous
Because
story.
It's a totally appropriate
No,
story.
You're right, but when you said CM Corn Booth, I said...
Well, yeah, I mean...
You should have played They're Rioting in Africa.
It's called The Merry Minuet.
Merry
is the
Minuet,
name of that
yes.
song.
Merry
and
Wolf.
No, this was the right song.
No, you're right. All right, the optimum word, James, is we must survive.
Yeah.
Good night.
Take care. And time for, well, it's 2 a.m. in New York here on WBAI New York, in fact. And we have time for one more call, 347-335-0818. Or else I will proceed to promote the two things that I want to promote. Or I can tell people about my new six-hour-a-day obsession. Total obsession. And it's so pleasing and occasionally calming and occasionally stomach-churning. But it's an internet TV show called Safari Live on wildearth.tv. You can pick it up on YouTube. It is... amazing. Watch it on a large screen, and you will be hooked. Good morning. You are on the radio.
Hey, Jim.
Hey there.
How you doing?
I'm not sure.
Oh.
How are you?
I thought the whole thing was going to end in a murder-suicide my own. You know, it's like, what? I mean, isn't it a parallel to like, as you were saying, we're like slipping into a different dimension?
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Mandela Effect.
Yeah.
I actually know people, I've had this thing and it happened, it was like, my universe is like Mandela was alive and became president, right?
Mm-hmm.
But here's my Mandela effect. You know the movie, The World, the Flesh, and the Devil?
Yeah.
Okay. I recently have a copy of it. Who's in it?
Harry Belafonte.
Right. Okay. I swear to God that I saw a version of that movie with Sidney Poitier.
There,
and I know the difference
There's another survivalist film,
Harry Belafonte, because, you know, we had records. I love Sidney Poitier. I saw him in A Patch of Blue on TV, and it was just like, you know, I know the difference. And I was like, wow, this is an incredible movie.
Well, there's many more.
Yeah.
There are several. It's a whole genre of post-apocalyptic movies with two, and then it turns out, uh-oh, it's three people.
And then there's five.
And one of them is a black man,
mm-hmm.
and a white woman, and a white man. And even Robert,
this is the one where it takes place in New York.
There are.
I don't know how they filmed it. Like, New York's so empty. It's like just the middle of Times Square, completely empty.
Well, when you're shooting a movie, you get to empty Times Square, especially at 5 a.m.
All right, can I go on? Because there's so much things I wanted to say.
Let me just mention the best film of that genre.
Uh-huh.
It's called The Quiet Earth.
All right. Here's my best science fiction movie, which I didn't mention. Mr. Nobody. Anyone see it?
I'm not sure.
Okay, it's kind of like, you know how they panned Cloud Atlas, which I didn't think was so bad?
Yeah.
There's another version. So here's the premise of this movie, and it's really weird, and it kind of like literally runs backwards. It's like the legend where people are born and the angel tells you to go shush and you have that little divot above your lip.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, all the people on a conveyor, all the children that are being reborn in, you know, heaven or whatever, and the angel comes over and goes, you know, somehow this character slipped the shush part. So when he was born, he was able to live all his alternative timelines simultaneously. So the movie begins with him as the last living human, immortal, telling his story, which is like everything, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like a pretty good premise. It's kind of like Cloud Atlas times 10. You know, as bad as Cloud Atlas. That's what I'm saying. It's like you give a movie a genre, and then there's like a better version of a movie, you know. But here's the best horror that I've seen since last year, which was It Follows. Southbound. It looks like a little movie. And I picked it up, and I was like, this is incredible. It's like it's an allegory, and there's like five different stories. But what makes this allegory really good is that they intertwine seamlessly. And it's like other characters from the other storyline like make cameos and like comment on what's going on. And some of them appear as like not what they were. And the first story is kind of like the sequel to the last story, which is like the prequel,
mm-hmm.
if that makes any sense. So it's like really fascinating. And to quote on the back, am I allowed to do that? Should I do that?
You can, but I'm going to want to...
It's Richard Roper, and it says, one of the smartest and scariest movies in recent memory.
Okay.
It gets my vote, too. Southbound.
Southbound. Okay, I'll check that out. And I'll check out Mr. Nobody. That sounds interesting. I'm looking.
You didn't see that one?
No, I haven't.
There's so many things that people just don't see or don't talk about.
It did not ever get wide release, Mr. Nobody. I'm looking it up now.
And
came out in 2009, got a lot of awards,
uh-huh.
Especially film festival awards, and it has, Jared Leto and Sarah Pauli, who are Reese Ifans and other, I don't know how to pronounce his last name really, but it's a, to begin with, it's not an American film, so it's a Belgian film. So it did not get wide distribution, and there was a lot of controversy, as they say, about that. Hopefully it's available
it's
on one
like
of the streaming
like
services.
It was kind of Terry Gilliam-ish.
Oh, I love those.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like it had that kind of, it's like not only phantasmical, but kind of like intellectual and artistic at the same time.
On Wikipedia is pretty interesting, I must say.
And I also mentioned, I mentioned to you last time the Slipstream, Anthony Pumpkin, that my ex-girlfriend used to mispronounce Anthony Hopkin movie.
Okay.
Written and directed.
Yeah, no, I still have not seen that. There's a lot that I want to see that I haven't seen, and there's so much more coming out.
I could get a mail-in address, because I just, for the first time, got a machine that's enabling me to take my... I swear to God, I came in late.
Well, I can give you email?
On the VHS, and I could send you copies of stuff that you would not believe.
Well, something like that you would send to care of WBAI 388 Atlantic Avenue. And I'm not let me look up the zip here.
You know what would be easier? And save postage. Ken lives in my neighborhood.
Oh, Ken Gale?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I talked to him like...
Well, I'll be seeing Ken soon.
Maybe 10 times or something.
Okay.
I told him about what I thought about the new Bond. Oh, my God.
It was awful.
What?
It was awful.
I've stopped watching Bond. I swore it off.
Skyfall was excellent, but
even
Spectre
before Spectre,
was
I watched
bad.
Spectre, even though I swore it off, and I was like, "Eh, Bond is outdated. Bond should be, put to rest unless it's going to go completely."
I disagree.
Harry Palmer.
I prefer Harry Palmer as well, but Harry Palmer is a very different kind of franchise.
Well, it's more true. I love Glenn Dighton.
And I'm also even more partial to John le Carré films.
Yeah, but I've been reading some Glenn Dighton, from the out-of-print, like Mystery Shops. That have
Glenn Dighton books, yeah.
Too, but the Glenn Dighton are
Dighton,
like,
yeah.
He's still like, I don't know, bestseller or something. It's amazing.
No,
something, I forget the name of it. It was a...
he wrote a lot of books.
He was a reporter at the fall of all the Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
And he just has all that, like spy... There's a glossary at the back of the book that's just so confusing.
Yeah, well, check out John le Carré's history.
I read some of that, too, and it's just... I don't know. Some things I like and some things I just don't, you know... Don't get into.
Well, start with Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the TV series starring Alec Guinness, not the movie. The movie's good.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's one of the best TV.
What's your rundown on the best TV sci-fi?
Oh.
Here's my Outer Limits.
No.
Well, I mean the original and the new.
The original. I did not care for it. Twilight Zone was so much better.
Some of them are clunkers, but some of them are like the one where Warren Oates is wearing eggs on his eyes. That's a little.
Outer Limits is more for the horror fan.
Well, there's a very what.
It
pulled no punches.
I've got readings to play. We can deprive people fearing science fiction writers reading their work.
Okay, I got my footprint in.
Okay.
And listen, don't worry about the government. You could play that song, but I mean.
Yeah, but
it's still the same. It's like same as it ever was. Whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. Just do something.
I know a little too much to not worry, but anyway.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
I'm not even worried about this government. I'm worried about other governments.
This is the time
and their reaction to us.
Look. Don't ever worry. Don't ever be scared, because it's like the time to be scared when you are scared. It's the time not to be scared, if that makes any sense at all.
I hear what you're saying, but...
That's my 2 cents.
But, you know...
And I'm sticking with it.
I'm from a Holocaust family. I know way too much. Over 30 people in my family killed. No, sorry.
I love it how everyone's just protesting. I just think that's the next step.
Well, you know, there are other things, and you know, I'm not a politician. I don't know about this stuff, and I don't have much time. I really have to play this thing. But I will say this: I would not be surprised if the president elect is indicted for any number of things before he can serve, which will leave us with Pence, which is, you know, I'm not sure how good a trade-off that will be. I'm not saying anything violent. I'm talking courts.
No,
I'm talking in the courts.
Conscientious objection.
There are, I think we will start seeing indictments handed down soon. That's what I think.
Let's all play poker somewhere.
Okay. Okay.
Okay, so
I've got to get off.
What I'm going to do, I'm going to send you a letter, and you tell Ken with my address, and you can tell Ken to contact me, and I will give Ken whatever. And he
okay,
will
or just
to
come to the next reading, which I'm going to announce as soon as I get off.
I have a comic book with a Halloween poem.
Cool.
That but, I'd like to read next time. I think I was cut on remember,
I need to get off.
But I want to send you one, too.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Okay. Good night, Jim.
Good night. Okay. I like taking that call. I like that caller. Don't have time. I have two readings. One is 16 minutes, and the other is 24 minutes. And do the math. And they both relate to readings next week. Only one of them is one that I'm producing. And that is this coming Tuesday, a special extracurricular New York Review of Science Fiction reading at right here. Except I'm on the third floor. These will be on the first floor at the Brooklyn Commons Cafe, 388 Atlantic Avenue. Admission is free. Donations highly encouraged. And we have two fabulous, wonderful people, one of whom you probably have heard of, and the other maybe you have, maybe you haven't. Kitch Johnson. Kitch Johnson is somebody who has taught so many great science fiction writers how to ply their craft through her work at the University of Kansas. And she, her bio says she writes short stories and occasional novels and has won the Hugo, Nebula, World Fantasy, and Theodore Sturgeon Awards. Her latest books are the Tor.com novella, The Dream Quest of Velit Boe, VELLITTBOE, and you just go to tor.com and you can read that, and The Riverbank, a sly response to The Wind in the Willows. And with her, somebody who I first encountered when we did something that you're about to hear, actually. Last April, we had the Clockwork Phoenix 5 launch party for that anthology, and we had seven people from that. And one of them I was introduced to through that event, Sonia Tafe. And she will be our other reader this coming Tuesday. A unusual spelling. We think it's Welsh. When I say we, I mean Sonia and I. And I interviewed her at ReaderCon. And I'm going to be playing that very soon. Not this morning. And Sonia Tafe, she's not as well known because she hasn't done a novel. She does have a book, a collection of fiction, short stories, and poetry called Ghost Signs, from Aqueduct Press, which is an independent press. Sonia Tafe reads dead languages for fun, edits living poets for Strange Horizons, and once named a Kuiper Belt object. That is absolutely true. It's quite something. And she lives in Somerville, Mass., with her husband and two cats. So, that is this coming Tuesday, the 15th. Now, mea culpa. There's another great reading series in New York. Usually we are the first Tuesday of every month. To try to put a fortnight between us, there's also the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series. And that is this coming Wednesday, where the readers will be both people who've been on this program, John Langan and Matt Kressel. And Matthew's new book is just out, as a matter of fact. Let's see, King of Shards, Queen of... Sorry, I'll tell you a little bit later. But that is on Wednesday, and this is my fault. Because originally we're actually going to have three readings in November and then one in December. And so I spaced them out 2 weeks apiece. And just stupidly did not realize that I had butted up against the KGB reading. So there's a reading on Tuesday and a reading on Wednesday. And it is not only because I feel guilty that I encourage you to go to the KGB reading, but it's also because they've got great people this month. They have great people most every month. But this month, both John Langan and Matt Kressel are great and fine. So admission there is free as well. It's Wednesday night at 7 o'clock at 85 East 4th Street, the KGB Bar, a lovely little place. You walk down, you'll see the Ukraine Theater on the steps going up. And then you walk up one flight of stairs, and there's the KGB Bar. And Ellen Datlow and Matt Kressel run that together, and Matt will be one of the readers, along with John Langan. John Langan has read for us at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings several times. And next, we are going to hear one of those events. And after that, time permitting, we will also have a reading from Sonia Tafe. If not this week, then next. And don't forget, by the way, that our event on Tuesday is carried on live stream. So if you go to live stream and look up NYRSF, NYRSF, for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, you can watch from wherever you are. In fact, if you were to do it, anytime you can see any of our readings from the last year. Sometimes they have noise problems. In fact, one of the reasons I'm a little reticent to play Sonia's reading is because we had to equalize the heck out of it to make it good. So, and partly for that reason, and partly as part of my mea culpa to John and to Matt and to Ellen, I will play a reading that John Langan did, I think in 2008. And I'm pretty sure this is a New York Review of Science Fiction reading. It might have been a KGB reading, but I think it was one of ours. So, having said that, and I didn't have a chance to preview the entire thing, so I'm going to be leaning back near the censor button just in case John decides to get naughty. Well, here we go.
Stories in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, two of which, Unschool Island and Mr. Gaunt, were nominated for the International Horror Guild Award.
I can tell you, this is John Joseph Adams introducing John. John was on our show, John Joseph Adams, just last week.
In Dead Reckonings, Extrapolation, Fantasy Commentator, The Internet Review of Science Fiction, Lovecraft Studies, and Science Fiction Studies, as well as other journals. An adjunct instructor at SUNY New Paltz, he's in the process of completing his dissertation on H.P. Lovecraft.
He's finished it by now. And by the way, now I know what this is from. This was from a book launch that we did for one of John's more successful anthologies, Wastelands.
Episode 7 is a reinvention of a story Langan wrote in his early 20s. This current version was influenced by another story in this volume, The End of the World as We Know It, by Dale Bailey. Langan says, Dale's story is a great revision of the classic mid-century post-apocalypse story. I admire what he'd achieved, but I also felt a bit of rivalry, a desire to show that not everyone would roll over and go gently into that good night. And with that, I'll turn it over to John.
So I can tell you...
That's a lie. I never said any of that.
I can now tell you for sure this is 2008, and this was held at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings when we were still at the Melville Gallery at the South Street Seaport. John, I'm sorry to interrupt you and step on your feet yet again. Please go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to read an excerpt from this long story. A little bit of setup. Everybody's dead. Our young hero and heroine, Wayne and Jackie, are on the run from a pack of monsters they call the Pack. The story is largely from Jackie's point of view. She's 7 months pregnant with her dead boyfriend's child. So as the story begins, they've crossed literally crossed a bridge and set up an ambush on the far shore. And now night has fallen. Jackie's sleep was light, troubled, Because sleeping soundly was impossible at this stage of pregnancy, not on a rock shelf in a sleeping bag at least, and because her dreams were vivid and disturbing, no surprise, so what to expect, assured her, pregnant women were subject to all kinds of anxiety dreams, a tendency compounded on her part by the last month's events, the long struggle to keep on the move and ahead of the pack, which had given her unconscious a whole new vocabulary of unease and terror. She was on that stretch of Route 9 where all the cars, 2-3 dozen, had come to a halt pretty much simultaneously, with the exception of a black SUV that had crumpled the trunk of the red sedan in front of it. She and Wayne peering through the car's windows at their interiors, every one crowded by purple flowers, anywhere from 1 to 4 per vehicle, stalks thick and twisting as snakes, blossoms the size of sunflowers, a kind of plant she'd never seen, and while she was no expert, botany was a hobby. Each flower an accumulation of overlapping petals, vaguely rose-like, except that each petal was 4 to 6 inches long, edges ragged, almost serrated, and a uniform eggplant hue. The flower centers obscured by clusters of closed petals that suggested mouths pursed for a kiss, an effect she found sufficiently unsettling to drop her eyes to the stems, parsley green, woody, covered in coarse hairs, fan-shaped leaves, tiny, almost vestigial. Jackie had studied the plants looped around steering wheels, gear shifts, headrests, door handles, pedals, one another, through windows dusted with violet pollen, each car a separate terrarium, thinking that none of this made any sense. There was no way for this size of plant to survive in this kind of environment, deprived, as far as she could see, of food and water. Before Wayne could stop her, she had grabbed the door handle of the car she was standing next to so she could open it and take a cutting from the flower whose blossom pressed against the window like a child's face peering out. But the stem held the door closed with surprising force so that the best she could manage was opening the door a crack, not enough to reach the plant, just sufficient for a small cloud of pollen to puff out. Then Wayne was there, pulling her back from the car onto the shoulder, though not before she'd inhaled some of the pollen, filling her nose with the astringent smell of lavender, which lingered for the rest of the day despite the fit of violent sneezing it precipitated. She had been annoyed at Wayne, not only for being so patronizing, but for reminding her that there wasn't much point in her taking a cutting. What was she going to do with it? She could put it under a microscope if they could find one. And then what? She was a college junior majoring in biology and minoring in psych. About the best she'd be able to do if she could study a slide of a purple flower would be to identify it as a plant. It wasn't as if she'd be able to offer any insight into their situation. She had stalked away from him as best she could and answered his regular questions of how she was feeling with the same monosyllable, fine, which was pretty much true except for the lavender smell. But that night she'd had dreams in which she was driving and her skin, which was incredibly itchy, so much so that she was finding it difficult to concentrate on the road, began to crumble beneath her fingertips, becoming powdery dusty, and suddenly all of her was on the verge of coming apart. For a moment she was aware of her entire body dry, loosening, streams of dust pouring from her hands, her chin, her fingers raining down over the steering wheel, her body dissolving against the seat, her feet reducing to powder in her shoes. She had time for the panicked thought that she couldn't breathe, then that didn't matter anymore, and she collapsed and woke with heart pounding, the baby kicking in response to her excitement. But that was fine, fine, because it meant she was still here, still in her body. For a good half hour, she ran her hands back and forth over her skin, reassuring herself with every pimple, every blemish, every strand of unwashed hair, that she was whole, not coming apart. Wayne must have noticed, but he remained silent, and another week would elapse before Jackie had gained sufficient distance from the dream and its sensations to narrate it to him. But to her surprise, he didn't have an interpretation ready, just grunted and didn't refer to it again. That dream sliding into one in which she was in her parents' den with Glenn, who was drunk again, still. He'd brought the bottle of gin and the bottle of tonic out beside the couch so he wouldn't have to travel so far to refill his glass, along with a bucket of ice from which he scooped half-melted cubes to deposit in his drink when it became too warm. The end of the world, or something close, and he'd spent pretty much all of it submerged in alcohol, because who was going to tell him not to? Her parents hadn't returned from the trip to ShopRite that shouldn't have taken them more than 2 hours, 3 at most, and that they'd left for 24 hours before, kissing her and ignoring Glenn, as they had ever since they'd learned the news of her pregnancy, promising to be back soon, a promise something had prevented them from keeping, which had her nervous but not as upset as she should have been. She wasn't done thinking they might yet appear, despite what the TV had shown before the channel started blinking off, whatever horror they'd been covering replaced by the tranquility of an electric blue screen. When Jackie climbed the stairs to the living room and looked out its picture window, all she saw was their slice of neighborhood, the same as ever. No fires, no riots, no people dying from whatever it was boiling the flesh off their bones, which had spread faster than the pundit's ability to hypothesize explanations for it. A new strain of bird flu had given way to a bioweapon, some kind of mutated smallpox, which was more plausible given its unbelievable virulence. But if so, whoever had released it had miscalculated, because it had taken the planet in its grip in all of 3 days. Terrorism had been supplemented by other, more fanciful explanations. Rampant nanotech set free during the mishap at that plant in Albany the week before. An alien virus imported by one of the meteors that had streaked across the sky a few nights ago. And of course, the wrath of God. And never mind that global events bore little to no resemblance to what was described in the Book of Revelation. The preachers who insisted on this answer had been so practiced at adapting biblical texts to their own ends, it was no surprise they should be able to do the same in this case. And what about those other pictures she and Glenn had seen, almost lost in the rush of things falling apart? That couldn't have been the shadow of something walking falling across that building in Chicago, could it? The thought was absurd. It would have had to be impossibly tall. But what had collided with Air Force One? Those hadn't been wings, had they? Equally ridiculous. You couldn't have a bird that size. She gazed out the window and saw movement, a car speeding up the road. For a second, she was sure it was her parents back from their trip at last. Then she realized it wasn't their Subaru, but a smaller car, a white Geo Metro, Wayne's car, which none of them ever stopped teasing him about, its engine straining as it raced along. And as she watched it, she was aware of something hovering over her, some badness preparing to fall on her and take her into its jagged gullet. And there was the opportunity for her to think, stay away, keep driving. Before, tires screaming, Wayne turned the car into her driveway, fishtailing half onto the lawn, spraying chunks of dirt and grass. Leaving the car running, he fell out of it and sprinted to the front door, hammering on it with both hands, shouting her name from a throat already worn hoarse. She remained where she was, hoping Wayne would race back to his undersized car and take away whatever catastrophe attended him, until she heard Glenn's slurred insistence that he was coming, for Christ's sake, keep your shirt on. So she crossed to the door, which Wayne had not stopped pounding on, fully intending to tell him to leave. Whatever it wasn't their problem. Amazing to think that she could so completely turn her back on Wayne, whom she'd described as her best guy friend, after Glenn, of course, for years. But the instant she turned the lock, the door leapt open, and Wayne was inside the house, shouting that she had to leave now, there was no time. Jackie registered his smell first, a heavy blend of copper and alkali. Blood and fear, she realized, as she took in his clothes, plastered and clotted with blood and other things. Was that a piece of bone? That pink clump? This was already bad. And finally, his words resolved themselves into sense, and she placed her hand on his arm, wincing at the blood still fresh to the touch. What had happened to him? Telling him to relax, calm down, it was all right. But none of her reassurances reached him. He kept insisting they had to go, and grabbed her by the arm, which was when Glenn found the top of the stairs. And who knew what he saw? The guy he'd never stopped worrying about, the source of his anxieties about their relationship, come to carry Jackie away at last. She should have anticipated what came next. But despite his macho posturing, Glenn had always seemed to her fundamentally gentle, peaceful. Still, there was nothing like a quart of gin and tonic to put you in touch with your inner linebacker, which he proved by barreling across the room, catching Wayne around the middle, and slamming him into the wall with sufficient force to drop them both to the floor. Wayne kept hold of Jackie as long as he could, tumbling her backwards onto the couch. Now Glenn was covered in gore, too, and raising his fist to pummel Wayne, who managed to wedge a leg between the two of them and kick Glenn off. off him, almost to the top of the stairs. Jackie, her hands pressed over her stomach, was shouting for the two of them to stop it. This was ridiculous. But Wayne hadn't liked Glenn any more than Glenn had him. Jealous, she knew, although she'd done her best to ignore the reasons fueling that jealousy. The two of them rushed together and went down in a tangle of arms and legs, grunting and cursing each other, and Jackie thought, great, watch Mom and Dad come home now. Then the picture window exploded inwards, and a massive snarling shape was standing in the living room, shaking glass off itself the way a dog might shake off water. She screamed, feet kicking her away from it, right up onto the couch. There was an instant for her to register the sheer size of the thing, its bulk. It had to stand 4 feet at the shoulder, with a hump that arched its back another foot over that, its head as big as a Thanksgiving turkey, its feet the size of dinner plates. And to think simultaneously, what's a hyena doing in upstate New York? And this is no hyena, before it pounced on Glenn, who had paused, arm upraised, when the window blew in. The thing caught his extended arm in its blunt jaws and tore it off at the shoulder, the crack and snap of bone and rip of sinew combining with the jet of blood and the scream from Glenn's throat and the growl from the thing's, a bass roar with the shriek of a violin on top of it. The thing held Glenn's arm dangling from its mouth like a puppy with a chew toy, then tossed the arm to one side with a flick of its head and lunged at him, while Wayne scrambled out of the way, his face blank with terror, and Jackie joined her scream to Glenn's as the thing bowled him back against the wall and seized his head between its teeth, his voice climbing registers she wouldn't have thought possible. Surely his vocal cords would have to give out. She didn't know how much more she could bear. The thing brought its jaws together. There was a pop and a crunch like an egg surrendering to the pressure of a hand, and Glenn's scream stopped, although Jackie's continued, pouring out her horror at what she was watching at the top of her lungs. Even when Wayne found his feet, stumbled across the living room to her, right past where the thing was busy feeding, almost slipped on a large piece of glass, took her hand, and started pulling her to the front door, which was still open, only to stop as a new sound flooded the air, a high-pitched cacophony like an orchestra out of tune, and dark shapes, who knew how many, 20, 30 more, galloped up the road, almost to the end of her driveway. Wayne's hand trembled in hers as if he were being electrocuted. Later, she would understand that his mind had been on the point of breaking, some fundamental motor about to snap its belt and seize up. She was taking in breath for another scream, because it was hard to take in enough air for a long scream when you were 6.5 months pregnant, courtesy of a bottle of Jack Daniels and the love of her life, who had just ended his life at the teeth of. When Wayne's hand stilled, she glanced at his face, and what she saw reflected there, a change from vacant-eyed terror to something else, stopped her voice. "Come on," he said, pulling her away from the front door across the living room, the thing growling and snapping at them, and oh my God, Glenn, into the kitchen and the cellar door, down the stairs and across the cellar to the oil tank, with a stop at her father's workbench to grab a rag and the box of long wooden matches Dad had had on his workbench for as long as she could remember. Overhead, the floor thumped and creaked, more of the things springing into the house. Wayne consulted the gauge on top of the oil tank and began unscrewing it. The gauge turned once, twice, then stuck. He ran back to the workbench for a wrench, while above, the things whined and growled, their claws skittering on the hardwood floor. Glenn, she thought, they're fighting over him, over what's left of him. Wayne had the gauge off. A thick petroleum odor filled her nostrils, and was dipping the rag into the tank, first one half, then the other. He left the rag hanging out of the tank and slid open the box of matches. "Go to the outside doors and open them," he said, selecting 3 matches, but not all the way, just enough to scope out the situation in the backyard. She did as he instructed, unlatching and shouldering up the metal doors that led out of the cellar. The arc of yard she could see was green and tranquil. "Good," Wayne said. "When I say now, throw open the doors and run for your neighbor's house, the yellow one." And before she could ask him how he expected someone 6.5 months pregnant to do anything that might remotely resemble running, he was scraping the first match along the side of the box. It popped into flame, and without pause, he touched it to the end of the rag. A tongue of fire licked the rag, and she was 10 feet across the yard before Wayne shouted, "Now!" behind her, her belly and breast swinging heavily, painfully, her legs protesting, threatening to cramp already, her lungs burning, not looking back because she didn't want to see the thing that killed her. She just prayed it would do so quickly. And Wayne was beside her, slowing his frantic pace to match hers. And they were at the edge of the yard when the oil tank blew, gutting the house in a yellow-orange boom that sent wood and glass spinning across the yard and triggered the gas tank beneath the window and, from the sound of it, Wayne's car. She could feel the heat from where she was, see the carcasses if she couldn't tell how many of the things sprawled around the house's wreckage. Glenn, she said, but Wayne was urging her on. Once she woke, saw Wayne sitting at the fire, and went back to sleep and more dreams. They were inside the walk-in urgent care building on Route 9, which Jackie had insisted they stop at for medical supplies, and because they needed to attend to the slash zigzagging up Wayne's forearm, which she'd bound to the best of her ability, but was worried was becoming septic. The skin around the black scab was yellow going to green, and the wound gave off a sweet smell that made her want to gag. At the very least, she wanted to locate a blister pack of Zithromax for him. At most, if she could locate proper tools, debride it. The advantage of having had a nurse mother who was a frustrated doctor. Wayne protested that he was fine, but went ahead of her through the building, a gun held in either hand, arms outstretched. Jackie had not yet decided she should be carrying a firearm, too, so she held the oversized flashlight they'd taken from her neighbor's house like a club. There was sufficient light in the corridors for her not to waste the batteries. Although the fluorescent lights overhead were dark, the ceiling opened into skylights at regular intervals, which leaked in enough of the gray, rainy day outside to permit her and Wayne their search. She wasn't sure what, if anything, they would encounter in the urgent care's dim interior. She was reasonably certain they had gained sufficient ground on what she had started referring to as the pack, following Wayne's lead, the name no doubt a comic book reference she wasn't plugged into, for them not to have to worry about coming face to snout with one of its snarling constituents. One or more of the strange purple flowers seemed more likely. Almost all the cars they'd seen on their trek up Route 9 had been full of the plants, although that was the only place they'd seen them. The various stores they'd entered for food, clothing, and assorted other supplies had been empty. She'd thought she had caught movement from the corner of her eyes, but when she'd looked, there had been nothing, most likely her nerves tricking her. Despite which, Wayne refused to abandon caution, leaping through every open door with both guns pointed ahead, then sweeping them to either side as he glanced around the room before calling clear to Jackie, who found his performance amusing in a way she knew she shouldn't have. Caution was warranted, and Wayne had proven his ability a number of times, from turning her house into a bomb, which had reduced the pack's ranks by at minimum a half, maybe 60%, to the previous day when he'd lured one of the pack's outriders into the walk-in freezer at a McDonald's and trapped it there. It was just there was an element of the performative to Wayne's actions, as if he were seeing himself doing whatever he was doing in the panels of a comic illustrated by one of his favorite artists. The last week and a half's events had damaged Wayne in ways you didn't need a degree in psych to notice, although you would need a postdoc to plumb their depths. She might be overreacting to the changes he'd displayed in his behavior, a ruthless, fiendishly inventive violence directed principally at their pursuers, or she might be misreading his response to the extremity of the past 11 days, but she was uncomfortably certain Wayne had developed a split in his personality, possibly a rough reorganization of his psyche that allowed him access to areas of his self previously roadblocked by norms of upbringing, society, and religion, possibly an entirely separate identity. It was as if he were living out one of the scenarios he'd read about for years, which might be the reason for her impression that, unimaginable psychic trauma and continuing horror and anxiety aside, on some level, Wayne was enjoying this, the world reshuffled into an arrangement he could deal with more competently and confidently than his previous existence of minimum wage labor and career stagnation. Each day's priorities, food, sleep, and movement. In the second exam room they entered, they found a locked cabinet that Wayne broke open. It was stacked with blister packs and bottles of antibiotics and other medications, which Jackie swept into the plastic shopping bag she'd taken from the Stop and Shop in great handfuls. In the third room, they found a steel box like an oversized pencil case that was full of scalpels, probes, and tweezers, as well as a dozen bottles of saline and an assortment of gauze bandages and rolls of surgical tape. Jackpot, she said, which had been her dead father's nickname for her until she turned 12 and refused to answer to it anymore. Wiping her eyes, she choked down nostalgia. She positioned Wayne with his arm on the edge of the room sink for the blood and had him hold the flashlight with his free hand. He wasn't happy about having to put down the guns, but in the absence of any better source of light, there was no skylight in this room, there was no other option. He settled for balancing the pistols on the opposite side of the sink and instructing her to duck if anything came through the door, which she assured him would not be a problem. She rinsed the scab on his arm with saline to moisten and loosen it, and went to work with the scalpel and probe, flaking away the crusted blood, easing the scalpel under more stubborn patches and levering them off, Wayne gasping as they tore away. Once the wound was exposed, she used half a bottle of saline to irrigate it, washing out assorted pieces of debris in the process, and had Wayne bring the flashlight in close so that she could study the cut, testing it as gently as she could with the probe, which made the light quiver, abandoning the probe for a pair of needling tweezers she used to pop a pocket of pus and lift a fragment of something out of it, which she thought was a fragment of one of the pack's teeth, and which she would have loved the chance to examine in greater detail, but which she didn't mention to Wayne, since he'd only remind her that she was a biology student, not a world-renowned scientist who might be able to learn something helpful from the sample. After which she rinsed the pus out, surveyed the arm one more time, was satisfied, squeezed a heavy stream of antibiotic cream over the wound, and began bandaging it. Jackie had done her best not to look at Wayne's face as she was working, not wanting her focus to be compromised by the pain she knew she'd find twisting his features. But with his arm cleaned and tended to the best of her ability, not to mention enough drugs to knock out any lingering infection, she relaxed and glanced at him, smiling, to leap back with a shriek at what she saw. Wayne's face gone from the mouth up, shrouded in heavy, oily blackness, as if someone had dumped a can of black paint over his head, except that instead of running down his skin, this was staying in place. Jackie backpedaled out of the room into the hall, colliding with one of the walls, Wayne following, saying, "What? What is it?" pointing the flashlight at her, then up and down the hall, then back to her, the glare dazzling, reducing him to a silhouette. Despite which, she could see something behind and above him, a cloud of blackness billowing out like a cape or a pair of wings. She held one hand over her stomach, the other over her eyes, as Wayne finally lowered the flashlight beam to the ground, still asking what it was, what was wrong. And when she risked a look at his face, it was clear of whatever she'd witnessed, if it had been there to begin with. Nor was there anything behind him. She dropped her hands, waving his continuing questions away with, "Sorry, I just freaked out," a response she knew didn't satisfy him, but that he was willing to let stand in the interest of maintaining their lead on the pack. So far as she could tell, he didn't suspect she'd seen what she had, whatever it was. Thank you.
Take a short break, and then we'll be back with Carol Imschwiller. In the meantime, there's books for sale over there, and also don't forget to donate to the Seaport. So, thanks.
No, John, it wasn't the Seaport people were supposed to donate to. It was me. But, hey, the Seaport was worth it as well. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial, Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and that was John Langan reading from the book Wastelands, an anthology edited by the host there, John Joseph Adams. And that was a good reading overall. 2008, John and Carol Imschwiller. That was worthy. John is going to be reading again this coming Wednesday at, I guess that'll be the 16th, next a week from tonight, but a few hours earlier, Wednesday, at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Bar, along with Matthew Kressel. And then I have a reading, holding a reading the day before. And one of the reasons I was playing John was because I felt awful about having unwittingly, stupidly scheduled a conflict, something that I raised my eyebrows at should it ever occur with them and vice versa. So, and this was like completely, totally, utterly my fault. But it's not just empty promotion, because Matt and Langan are great. That reading series is great and all that. But it shouldn't stop you from coming to ours. Sonia Tafe, okay, we did run out of time. I don't have time to play you Sonia Tafe's reading, but you from last April. But that's actually available online. It's on, if you go to livestream.com, or if you have the Livestream app on your phone or on your Roku box, you can look up Clockwork Phoenix. The Clockwork Phoenix 5 reading from last April, April 5th. And the whole thing was pretty wonderful. There was some loud buzzing during that, but we're going to clean that up real soon. But Sonia was the first reader after the intermission. But hey, watch the whole thing. We had a lot of great people, including C.S.E. Cooney with Carlos Hernandez and Claire. C.S.E. Cooney just won the World Fantasy Award, by the way. So congrats, Claire. And Barbara Krasnoff and Shveta Thrakrar and so forth. So this coming Tuesday, Kidge Johnson and Sonia Taith, two wonderful writers. It fell out on that date because that was Kidge is in New York for all of 3 days. She rarely gets here. This is the first time that she's been here in like 8 or 9 years. And last time was because she was at the Nebula Awards toasting that year's Grandmaster, James E. Gunn. One of the grand old writers of science fiction and still very much involved in academia of science fiction. Also runs the Science Fiction Audio Project. But Kidge is a great writer, and Sonia Taith is just, she is, a polymath. She is a polymath. At like age 17, she built a telescope in her backyard. And not only did she build a telescope that worked, but she looked out and she was comparing different objects that she could find in the sky and found one that wasn't like on the books at all. She found an asteroid. And so she actually had the honor of naming a Kuiper Belt object. That, you know, the International Astronomical Union got together and met, she had chosen a particular Greek name in keeping with what they did. And she had discovered and got to name an asteroid. I mean, that's pretty bleeping cool is all I can say about that. And her writing, the story that I'm not playing right now that you could hear, had to do with J. Robert Oppenheimer and a golem that he was using at command, which is all very, very curious and wonderful. Just a wonderful, wonderful mix. And Kidge, right, just come Tuesday. This coming Tuesday at 388 Atlantic Avenue, the Brooklyn Commons Cafe, for the New York Review of Science Fiction readings for Kidge Johnson and Sonia Taith. Show up about 6:30. Events will begin about 7 o'clock. And then the next night, because you're going to go on a science fiction literary pub crawl, as it were, cafe crawl. Well, one's a cafe and one's a bar. You'll go to the KGB bar at 85 East 4th Street, same starting time, to hear Matthew Kressel and John Langan. Admission in both cases are free. At one, we ask for donations. At the other, they suggest that you buy a drink from the bar that so graciously gives them the space for their events. At the top of the show, I was talking about sort of, I woke up today with a reemergence of the kind of angst that I had as a kid during nuclear nightmares and stuff like that. And I forgot to mention, it was not lost on me that yesterday, Wednesday, it's now in New York, Thursday, if you're listening in LA, it's Wednesday. Okay, so yeah, got that. Okay, unless you're listening to the podcast, I don't know when it is. That's your problem. But God help me. That the 9th and the 10th of November, in which we have had such devastating news, is Kristallnacht. And I mentioned that my parents were both Holocaust survivors, and it is a date that strikes terror for a great many people. It was for a single day, one of the worst actions ever taken against a single group of people, not counting Hiroshima. But that was an alleged, that was a military action against civilians. The other was the government turning people against their neighbors. That was the whole point of Kristallnacht, was, you know, it means basically glass night. The idea was to break people's glass and all that. And when I say people, of course, I mean Jews. To them, they weren't people. We weren't people. And the same bleeping thing started today. It started in Philadelphia, mostly in Jewish places in Philadelphia, but elsewhere in Muslim places. I will get pedantic at you and say they're attacking Semites. That is absolutely correct, because both people of, well, not all Muslims, but all people of Arabic background and Jewish, Israeli background are all Semites, because of the language. The Arabic language and the Hebrew language are both Semitic languages. This is a, referring to somebody as a Semite is identifying the root language that their people speak. So remember, when you call somebody anti-Semite, that applies just as well to people who hate people from anywhere in the Middle East. It's not just us Jews. It's us people who love our neighbors who are good in Egypt, in, well, any part of Arabia, but most significantly right now, our neighbors here in New York and Philadelphia and the rest. And the events of the portent, the fact that so many Americans voted in this demagogue, this racist, this sexual predator, in my opinion. I have to add, that's my opinion and not the official opinion of WBAI, because, well, there are legal issues there. But this is my opinion, and you cannot stop me from expressing my opinion until they revoke the First Amendment. That won't be until at least January 15th or so. So, you know, because we will see how it goes. But I'm unhappy. That's the best way to put it. I'm unhappy. So when I tell you to be good to each other, I mean it. It has become my sign-off. I stole it from Stephen Fry on his game show, QI. He's no longer the host, but he did it for 13 years. And he would always say, you know, please be good to each other. And I agree. Be good to each other. Be good to yourselves, for that matter. Treat humans like humans and as humans deserve to be treated. And the rest is BS. Okay, it's just like not your place. If you can't play well with others, take a time out until you can. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way over these same airwaves in just about 3.5 minutes. And, well, as I said, be good to each other. I hope to see you all on Tuesday. We'll have a wonderful time. I will try to get to KGB next Wednesday. It's difficult for me to do so because, well, I have show Wednesday night. And when I come in Wednesday night, we'll all find out what I do. You can join the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook. You can write me there. You can also follow me on Twitter, JimFreund, or you can even visit my website at ourwolf.com. Have a good morning. Take care and stay tuned.
Yeah. slave ship. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru. Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea. Beirut, can't forget Haiti. Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. The free book. This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother.
Yeah.
You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
And you're tuned to Radio Station WBAI 99.5 FM, Lister Live. WBAI. This is the unknown Black Burning Show. Anywhere. 5 minutes after the hour, 5 minutes after Black Burning time, 3 o'clock. And we're in the streets demonstrating against this white supremacist in the White House.
From reggae, I get it to the revolutionary step. I dance, you will never forget to the revolutionary step. Step forward, brothers and sisters, step forward. Now if you wanna sweat, yeah. The beat you get and jump for the better, faster and higher. Let the music get to your bones, move on the tip of your toes like a lion in the jungle. The revolutionary step. I dance from reggae, I can get to the revolutionary step. I dance, you will never forget to the revolutionary step. Step forward, brothers. Step forward. No LSD. No. Not any cocaine. No. To want to do it again and again. To you, it may look hard to do, but believe I
Terry Wilson from Midnight
Don't
Ravers.
Just that man. Don't just that man could lose his trust.
99 Cinco, List Alive.
So many people have lost their trust in Jah. Jah know, that man could be any man. When you talk about trust, you got to be careful. But just most times cause a lot of us. Jah know that man could be any man. Sometimes we got to look way back in life and try to remember the good times we had without no fun. Things have changed. Don't trust that man. That man could lose his trust. So many people have lost their trust in Jah. Jah know. That man could be any man. Sometimes we should give it a try again. That nice time we usually have, we don't know fun. Jah know, that man could be any man. Jah know. You can't blame no one. People want to be safe and taken care of when you talk about trust.
Jano, 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 that man could be any man. Sometimes you will hear some people say, trust me, I can get the work done. Don't trust that man, don't trust that man could lose his trust. So many people have lost their trust in Jah. Jah know, Jah know, Jah know, Jah know, that man could be any man.